We now continue with Tell Us Another. How a Little Rose Died. Once upon a time, in the fair month of June, a rose bush grew at the wayside. The rosebuds were already plump and full. Soon they would burst open. Some fragrant morning, maybe. But one of them would not wait. It wanted to bloom before the rest. So what did it do but crowd on ahead of the others? And sure enough, one fine morning, this little bud was spreading out its petals in the summer sun. Everybody admired it. But alas, it had been in too great a hurry. It was not strong. It had not enough sap. So when the sun became hot, and the rose grew faint and withered away. Poor little blooming rose! Its head drooped so pitifully. Then, because it had pushed its way so much to the front, it was seen by worms, and they came and gnawed at its heart. Pretty soon the petals of the little rose dropped to the ground and were blown away by the wind. But after a few days, the other buds broke open slowly and began to bloom in all their fresh and healthy beauty. Many days they bloomed, and they were the joy of everyone that saw them. The little rose that died might have had it just as nice if it had not been in such a hurry to stop being a modest little bud. I knew another rose. She was a rosebud in the springtime of life, but she was only one of a number of buds, plump and full of the many things learned, that graduated from school one year. Soon they were to bloom from the rosebud of maidenhood into the rich flower of womanhood. But one of them, Rose, could not wait. She wanted to bloom before the rest. So what did she do but crowd on ahead of the others? She was seen everywhere. No dance was complete unless Rose was there, and she would be gay until the wee small hours of the morning. Everybody talked about her. She was so popular. But alas, she had been in too great a hurry. She was too young and weak for such a life. Poor, popular little Rose! She began to droop and fade away. And then the ugly worms of sin came and gnawed at her heart. And pretty soon the petals of her beauty dropped to the ground and were blown away by the wind of time, never to return. And when the other buds, the other girls of her class, had grown to be fair, blooming flowers of maidenly modesty, strong in homemade virtue, poor little Rose seemed old and faded, and nobody cared for her any more. She might have had it just as nice as the other girls, if she had not been in such a hurry to stop being a modest little bud. The Little Jar of Tears. Yes? Little Rosie had cried herself to sleep that night, and even while she dreamt, an occasional deep sob broke from her unconsciously. 'Twas really too bad that the tiny girlie had always to be weeping. "Oh," said a soft voice at her side all of a sudden, "why are you weeping, darling?" Rosie looked up and saw a beautiful angel bending over her. Then she gazed upon the starry heavens, and such a holy desire seized her that she wept tears of longing. So the angel put his arms about Rosie, and away they flew up to heaven. In the twinkling of an eye they were there. Of course they had no difficulty at all with Saint Peter. He of the keys let them come in at once. Now what do you think Rosie's first question was? Why, just what yours would be, of course, and mine too. "Can I see God at once?" she asked. "I want to see God." "Oh, no," said the angel kindly. "You may not yet see God, sweet and tiny soul. Never could mortal eye look upon him and live, so great is his beauty and his splendor. No, dear, you must die before you can see God in heaven." So they merely took a look at an antechamber of that glorious kingdom, went into an entry, so to speak. Its walls were lined with little jars, all of the same size. "These are tear jars," said the angel. "Every tear that a person weeps on earth is collected by his guardian angel and placed in a special jar here in this little room." Little Rosie was becoming curious. She peeped into the number of jars. Some were almost full. Some were almost empty. "Dear Angel," said the girlie, "some are almost empty."
"It is better so," the angel replied. "The best and happiest lives are often those of the fewest tears, though not always, to be sure. It is sunshine that makes the flowers of virtue grow, though rain must come sometimes, too." Rosie was still peeping into the jars. At last she found one that was almost full.
"That is your jar," said the angel. "When it is full, you must die."
"Oh!" cried the little girl, so frightened that she jumped up and found herself in her little bed, with the rising sun smiling into her face and kissing away the last vestige of a tear that was hanging there, just as it kisses away a dewdrop from a flower. But Rosie did not forget the little jar of tears. She thanked her guardian angel for the little lesson, and promised God that she would always make herself and others, and especially the loved ones around her, happy by the presence of her smile and the absence of her tears.
A Prisoner of War. They were playing in the garden, all blooming as it was with the foliage of May. Suddenly Paul, who was ever seeking new adventures, cried out, "Rose, come here! See what I've captured!" In a moment, light-hearted Rose was at his side, her eyes brimful of fun and eager expectation. "What is it?" she asked breathlessly.
"A Maybug," said Paul. "I caught him as he was sailing gaily from tree to tree. I say, Rose, let's make him our prisoner of war. Rush up to our room and bring one of those little paper boxes. Hurry!" And away Rose skipped. Soon she was back again, box in hand. "But," she hinted anxiously, "he can't live in here. He must have air and food. Won't he suffer, Paul?"
"No, not in the least," returned Paul confidently. "We'll make some holes in the cover here and place some fresh green grass at the bottom. Then our Mr. Maybug will live like a king in a palace. Now, Rose, you just run to the kitchen and ask Mother dear for a sugared tart and a bit of honeycomb. With such dainties, our captive will surely be more than delighted with his prison palace." Rose hurried away, quite convinced. Although a year older than Paul, she was always ready in all things to acknowledge his superior wisdom. "Of course," she softly assured herself, "Paul cannot be mistaken." Upon arriving at the kitchen, she told her mother the whole story in a breath, and having taken the delicacies for which she had come, she was hastening away. "But Rose," expostulated her mother, "do you think this little creature really finds delight in being a prisoner of war? I'm sure he will miss the air and the birds and the flowers and the grass. And will he not long for the company of his fellow Maybugs and for many other things? Tell Paul to let him go, Rose." But Rose, in her haste, had not heard these last words. She was out in the garden again with Paul. The two little enthusiasts then safely confined this prisoner of war in what they were pleased to call his palace prison. Holes at the top, fresh green grass at the bottom, sugared tart and a bit of honeycomb. Surely this would make their Maybug happy. But now, tired of play, they skipped up to their room, taking their Maybug with them. It was Saturday morning. They had already finished their lessons for Monday, for Paul and Rose were ever diligent in preparing their tasks. There was nothing more to be done. The day was theirs. They could enjoy themselves, oh, ever so much. First they began with games. Then came the picture books. Their prisoner of war was entirely forgotten. So absorbed were they in a large and wonderful picture book that they did not notice the rapid passage of time. They did not notice that the dinner hour had passed. They did not even know that someone had quietly entered the room and had as quietly left it again, so very interesting was their book. Finally, Rose looked up. There, upon the table, stood a large basket which had not been there before. Where had it come from? What could it contain?
"It wasn't here before, Paul," said Rose. "Why," she added, peering into it, "look, it's our dinner."
"Mother wishes us to take our dinner here for some reason, it seems," said Paul. "What can be the matter? And see, Rose, all our favorite dishes are here, too." It was customary for the family to dine during the summer months in a breezy little tent put up in the shady garden. "How much nicer," said Paul, as he munched the juicy blueberry pie and handed Rose a sugared tart. "How much nicer it would be down there in the beautiful garden. It's so close here. There are no breezes, no birds, no trees. There's nothing lovely here."
"Well," said Rose, "after dinner we'll make up for it. We'll go right down to the garden and play all afternoon. I'm tired of this old room already." And after they had eaten, they hurried to the door. What was their astonishment when they found it locked! Again and again they rapped and called and rapped, but it was in vain. No one seemed to hear them.
"What can it all mean?" exclaimed Paul, and he was dangerously near to crying.
"Oh, I don't know," returned Rose as she burst into tears and began to sob. Paul joined in, and together they wept aloud. But he, being the wiser, was also the more manly, and soon ceased crying. Then he tried to console Rose. He read a book to her, but poor Rose could not pay attention. And so the long hours of the afternoon passed slowly away, and the two children stood at the window and looked down upon the shady garden. Butterflies were flitting about. Flowers were looking up at them. The empty swing was swaying in the breeze. The little carts with which they had intended to play with were idle in the shade. "How pleasant it would be down there," they exclaimed again and again. But it was not to be. They were captives. The shadows in the garden below had lengthened exceedingly when they thought to hear a footstep at the door. Immediately, they began to rap again. They heard their mother's voice. "Oh, mother dear, open the door for us," they cried. "Someone has locked us in. All afternoon have we been here." And they began to sob anew. As soon as their mother had entered the room, they flew into her arms and clung to her as if for life. Into her ears they poured out their tale of woe, their loneliness, what they had missed. "But," said their mother sweetly, "did I not send you a most excellent dinner, your favorite dishes? And haven't you, my dear children, a nice airy room here? Haven't you beautiful books and playthings of all kinds? What more can you desire?" "But we were not free," sobbed Rose. "We could not romp and play. We could not enjoy the green grass, nor the pretty flowers, nor the leafy trees." "And do you not think," said their mother gently, "that the Maybug, whom you imprisoned, misses all these things too?" "Oh, our prisoner of war!" cried Paul and Rose with one voice. "We had forgotten all about him. We'll let him go at once, at once." They hurried to the Maybug's palace prison on the window sill. He was humming and buzzing in a most disconsolate manner. They opened the box. There he sat on the grass at the bottom, quite dreary and forlorn. When he saw that freedom was offered him, he spread his wings and gaily flew down, down into the blooming garden. There he joined three fellow Maybugs, who were seemingly in wait for him. Together they sported among the foliage with all the liveliness and evident glee of which Maybugs are capable. As they turned away from the window, Paul gave his mother a boyish embrace and said, "Oh, mother, I see it all now. You are teaching us a lesson. You wish to show us how hard it is to be deprived of freedom." And he looked ashamed. "Oh, yes, mother dear," cried Rose, "and we thank you for it. Oh, let us go down into the garden now." And in her great joy she kissed her mother thrice and again. "Yes, Paul," said their mother fondly, "you and Rose are right. 'Twas a little lesson I was teaching you, a Saturday lesson. Remember that all God's creatures, however small, feel and suffer. Be kind and gentle to them always. God, you know, made them all." And Nellie was sorry. "Open your mouth and shut your eyes," said Nelly to her brother George. Weary of fun and frolic, they were resting on the lawn swing one glorious summer's day. Nelly had skipped into the house on some mysterious errand and had just returned. George, who was 2 years older than Nelly, was as jovial and indulgent a lad as one could hope to find anywhere. So now, both to please Nelly and also because he saw something white and sugar-like hidden in her hand, he obediently opened wide his mouth and tightly shut his eyes. The result was 2 minutes of unlovely spitting and sputtering, for instead of the lump of sugar which George had expected, he had received a dose of salt. Strange to say, Nelly enjoyed the scene immensely. She thought of it a capital joke. Running into the house again, she soon returned and repeated her request. "Open your mouth and shut your eyes." "Ah," thought George, "she's sorry, and surely she will now take this bitter taste out of my mouth by giving me something sweet." So once again he expectantly opened his mouth. Then Nelly placed a piece of charcoal into it and quickly ran away. George did not say anything, but he thought it very mean of his sister to act thus, and resolved, "I'll get even with her very soon. Just wait and see." Only the next day his chance came. They were out in the garden. Nelly was chasing and trying to capture some beautiful butterflies, while George strolled about admiring the beautiful flowers and the fresh green plants. Coming to a cherry tree, which was all aglow with the ruddy fruit, he began to pick a hatful. When he was about to leave, he noticed some large, green, pricky gooseberries growing near at hand. "Ha," he said to himself, "here's what I can fool Nelly and pay her back." Then he picked a handful and went to find Nelly. "Open your mouth and shut your eyes," he commanded when he had found her. Nelly looked suspiciously at her brother and then at the hat, but she didn't see what George had, for he had placed the gooseberries on the cherries and had covered the whole with some large leaves. So she was somewhat afraid, for she remembered how naughty and unkind she had been the day before. Would George, in revenge, perhaps put a beetle into her mouth, or even one of those caterpillars she hated so much? Still hesitating, she slowly opened her mouth and shut her eyes. George reached into the hat and took out a big, sharp-pointed gooseberry. But then, seeing Nelly so innocent, so half-sorry, half-afraid, and hearing perhaps the gentle voice of his guardian angel, he replaced it, and taking instead a large, juicy cherry, put it into Nelly's mouth. His sister shut her mouth and opened her eyes with wonder and delight. With great satisfaction and pleasure, she ate the cherry. "Open your mouth and shut your eyes." Again and again George gave the command, and Nelly, although she soon forgot to close her eyes, partook of the luscious cherries until she had her fill. George afterwards said that never had he felt such exquisite delight, such consoling joy, as he experienced while giving his sister cherries for salt, cherries for charcoal, good for evil. And Nelly was sorry. She saw what a noble boy her brother was, and what an unkind little girl she had been. Humbly she asked his pardon.
We don't talk in church. Alice was only a girlie, but she was very good. If she hadn't been, I wouldn't be writing about her now. One Sunday she knelt in church during Mass, saying her prayers from her little prayer book. During the Holy Sacrifice, a richly dressed lady came in and sat down at Alice's side. She was not a Catholic, so she did not kneel at all, but just sat and watched what was going on. Everything that took place at the altar, the priest and his sacred vestments, that altar with its lights, the ceremonies, the altar boys in their cassocks and surplices, was strange to her. She was puzzled. Soon she became so curious that she bent over and whispered to Alice, asking her what it all meant.
And now just see what an extra good girl Alice was. She wanted to be polite, so she took her pencil and wrote on the fly leaf of her prayer book the words, "Please, we don't talk in church." This she showed to the lady. Was the lady angry? No, and she did not say another word, but she thought to herself, "This church must be a holy place. It's not like our Protestant churches. There must be something sacred and wonderful about this religion. I'll have to find out more about it." So she went home and read good books about the Catholic faith. Then she went to see a priest. Then she took instructions and became a Catholic. Who made her a Catholic? Alice, by her good example and without saying a single word, preached the little sermon that did the great good work. And her reverence for the Holy Mass and the Blessed Sacrament prompted her to preach it. Now isn't it true that children can be God's apostles if they only want to? 5. Father, forgive them.
Black Robe, what is your desire?
It was down in Texas half a score of decades ago, when that country, not even now quite tame, was a wilderness and wild, inhabited by numerous and bloodthirsty bands of reciprocally inimical savages, North American Indians, we are wont to call them. Immigration to the Lone Star State was just beginning then, that deceptive immigration which lured thousands and thousands of foreigners to the weary wastes and boundless prairies of the great Southwest, there sadly to delusion them and to add to unimproved temporal affairs a frequent loss of faith and spiritual goods, owing to an almost entire absence of the maternal ministrations of Holy Church. But zealous missionaries are to be found always and everywhere, for God has ever raised up hardy and self-sacrificing men to do that pioneer work which enables the Church to boast of universality in the most common acceptation of the world. Such a hero was Bishop Auden, Texas missionary, of wide repute, indeed, but better known to God than to men, like of all his kind, and reigning now, we may confidently hope, with the Lord of all tribes and peoples. Astounding would be the recital of the hardships which he endured, of the sacrifices which he made, in order to convert some, at least, of the Indians of Texas to the God they knew not. Only the faith of Christ can inspire mortal men to bear what our Catholic missionaries have ever borne. Before the mind's eye of such heroes, there must needs float continually the image of Christ crucified, that first great missionary, who endured hardships and suffered deprivations awfully, unutterably immense, and who died upon an infamous gibbet in unspeakable agony for the salvation of immortal souls. Yes, indeed, the heart of the apostolic missionary must beat in union with the sacred heart of Jesus, dying upon the cross. He must follow in the footsteps of the Master who died that men might live forever in heaven. For the servant is not above the Master. Of such a spirit was Bishop Auden. 20 years had he already toiled among the savage tribes of the southern prairies. It was then that the incident took place that is here related. One day, during a missionary tour among the scattered Indian tribes, a small detachment of warlike savages called upon him, earnestly requesting him to visit their chief, who had been severely wounded by an arrow in battle. Bishop Auden had some knowledge of medicine and surgery, especially as regards the concoction and application of herbs, and such like rude but effective remedies of the wilderness. This the Indians knew, and this it accordingly was that not infrequently obtained entrance for him into tribes and villages and wigwams to which he would not otherwise have access. Such was the case in this particular instance. Full of sympathy and urged by charity, the bishop unhesitatingly consented to accompany the rude delegation, and immediately made the few preparations necessary for the journey. For 2 whole days they marched onward, making a beeline for the village in a truly Indian fashion, traversing trackless forests and boundless prairies, and with the heavens above as their only tent.
But ere the third day was half spent, they arrived at the wigwams of the afflicted tribe. Some refreshments having been offered to the missionary by the natives, he was led into the wigwam of the chief. A powerfully built redskin, in the prime of life, lay upon a rude couch of leaves, grass, and moss. He was still adorned with all the trappings of his dignity. Weapons of various kinds lay scattered about in the wigwam, and on the posts hung bunches of hair, the scalps of the conquered, the gruesome emblems of Indian victory. Near the couch lay a shell full of some refreshing drink for the suffering warrior. An enemy's deadly arrow had inflicted a mortal wound in his side. But with stoical indifference he gazed into space, scarcely noticing this visitor, and enduring his agony with the heroic resignation of the manly chieftain. Yet his breath came and went in short, quick gasps, breathing forth, as it were, his well-nigh irrepressible pain. But now he turned a warrior's fearless eye towards the missionary, and spoke the above words in the deep guttural of the savage.
"Black Robe, what is your desire?"
"I would ask whether I can be of any assistance to you, or whether I may procure your admission into the beautiful wigwam of the Great Spirit," answered the missionary.
"Black Robe, I am past all cure. The arrow struck my life." And he showed the priest the ugly, gaping wound. It was indeed beyond all cure. "But," he continued, "do you speak to me about the Great Spirit?"
"If you would enter into the beautiful wigwam of the Great Spirit, you must believe everything that he tells you through me, and you must let me wash your head."
"What says the Great Spirit?"
Calm and serious was the gaze which the savage chieftain fixed upon the missionary. The latter then began to speak of God, who created heaven and earth and all things else, the one only God, who is the ruler and preserver of the universe, who has revealed himself to man in three divine persons, in order to show him the way to his beautiful wigwam. The chieftain nodded his assent in approbation. "These things are not new to me," he said slowly. "Also I know of the Great Spirit, and that he has spoken to men." But the missionary continued. He spoke of the happiness of man in God's garden of paradise. He told of how our first parents fell into sin, thus bringing upon themselves and upon their descendants the curse of God, untold misery, suffering, sickness, and death. The chief did not seem at all to marvel. "All these things have my fathers also taught me," he said. But now the priest began to speak of God's great mercy, his pity for the poor, fallen mankind. He told of how the Son of God had become man and had come to earth to save the human race, to make men happy again, to lead them back to the beautiful wigwams of the Great Spirit. At these words the wounded savage raised himself slightly. His features, distorted by pain, assumed an expression of complete astonishment.
"Black Robe," he exclaimed, "that is beautiful and good to hear. What you now say is very good to hear, and makes the heart laugh." Then his glance fell, and he became silent.
"This Son of God," continued the missionary after a pause, "has sent me to you to tell you what you must do."
"And what is that, Black Robe?" asked the dying Indian without raising his eyes.
"He wants you firmly to believe in him and to love him with your whole heart."
"Black Robe, all that I have done, even from the moment you mentioned his name, I have done it. Why should I not believe the Great Spirit?"
With that he extended his hand to grasp the priest's and press it to his forehead.
"Not only must you love him," said the missionary, "not only must you love him who became man for you, but also all men, even your enemies."
Scarcely had he uttered these words when the Indian cast upon him a quick glance of utter amazement.
"Even my enemies?" he asked, in a voice of surprised incredulity, as his eyes glowed and flashed fire. "You desire, Black Robe, that I forgive my enemies?"
He placed his hand upon the gaping wound in his side. No, the Indian warrior cannot do that. For when I am gone, my brothers must revenge my death. Black Robe, 7 men shall fall to blot out the chieftain's death. Such a law is given among the red men. An enemy is not to be forgiven. Then he paused, too much weakened to continue. The thirst for revenge had exhausted the little remaining strength of the wounded warrior. For a moment the missionary was silent. Then, in calm, persuasive tones, he assured the chief that not he, but the Great Spirit, commanded this. Even the Great Spirit, who created all things, and who became man out of pity for the fallen race. But the Indian shook his head and sought to expostulate, saying that it could not be so, and that the Great Spirit could not issue such a command. Blood must be revenged by blood. Such was the teaching his fathers had handed down. Thereupon, 2 other savages, who were in the wigwam, likewise sought to convince the priest of the entire lawfulness of bloody vengeance. He bade them be silent. "But you surely wish to dwell in the beautiful wigwam of the Great Spirit," urged the missionary, "and so do your enemies." At this the missionary began to despair of the chieftain's conversion, but he seized the crucifix suspended from his neck, held it up to the Indian's gaze, and exclaimed, "Behold, O Indian chief, the Son of God, who in his great goodness came to earth to save fallen mankind, was also wounded unto death by his enemies. And this Redeemer, in order to procure your entrance into the beautiful wigwam of the Great Spirit, this Redeemer, while hanging upon the cross, asked the Great Spirit, his Father, to forgive his enemies. That is what the Son of God did, Indian chief. And you are not willing likewise to forgive your enemies?" The dying warrior was dazed with astonishment. He gazed upon the crucifix. A look of utter amazement spread over his features. "Black Robe, do you speak truth when you say this?" "Yes, I speak nothing but the truth." The missionary ceased speaking. The chief fell back upon his rude couch and remained quiet for a long time. Exteriorly, he was calm and seemingly indifferent, but interiorly, a mighty struggle must have been taking place. No one dared to break the tense silence. Finally, the Indian spoke in deep, earnest tones. "Swear to me, Black Robe, swear by the Great Spirit that what you say is truth." And the missionary answered with a voice in which there was a ring of persuasive solemnity, "I swear it by my God, who is also your God, and who has sent me to seek the red man and to do him good. For the Great Spirit also made your enemies, and he wishes likewise to show mercy to them. But now enemies cannot live together in the beautiful wigwam of the Great Spirit, because eternal peace dwells there. Hence forgiveness must take place on earth." All this the dying warrior could not comprehend, for where human passions are concerned, there the intellect is doubly darkened and the will thrice weak. He shook his head and instinctively clutched a murderous tomahawk which lay near, and grim revenge distorted his features, in which could already be seen signs of approaching dissolution. "Black Robe, if it be truth that the Son of the Great Spirit, dying upon the cross, besought pardon for his enemies and forgave them, then also I must do even as he did." The chief turned to the 2 Indians. "Summon the men of the tribe," he said. The savages instantly obeyed, leaving the missionary alone with the suffering warrior. Both were silent, but in his heart the priest was sending up fervent prayers to the God of pardoning love for the soul of this poor mortal. Meanwhile, he did what little he could for the chief's comfort. The latter showed himself grateful for the least service. Gradually, the wigwam was filled with braves, all armed to the teeth. They formed a semicircle around the couch of their chief and waited expectantly. The most renowned men of the tribe were there. "I must die," the wounded Indian began, after the last men had entered. "The Great Spirit has sent this black robe to me, and I must let him wash my head in order that I may enter into the Great Spirit's beautiful wigwam. But first I must do what the Great Spirit did, and that is but just. He forgave his enemies. Also I wish to forgive my enemies." The assembled braves stared at him in astonishment. Not one dared to speak. "Warriors, braves, swear to me by the Great Spirit for my sake to take no revenge on my enemies. I, your chief, desire it. Cast aside your weapons and swear." And the warriors cast their weapons to the ground and swore as the chief desired. The missionary now called for water in order to baptize the dying Indian. When the latter beheld these preparations, he said, "Lift me up." The priest tried to dissuade him, seeing that every movement caused him excruciating pain. "Indian braves, lift me up and lay me on my face," he repeated. "I feel that the Great Spirit himself would speak to me." The men did as he commanded. Thereupon the veteran warrior received the sacrament of baptism with the resignation and simplicity of a child. His soul was washed whiter than snow. His fellow warriors were moved to the heart. At a sign from the priest, they then left the wigwam, only to be converted a few days later to the faith of their departed chief. The missionary remained with the dying Indian yet another day, teaching him to pray, and rejoicing in the contemplation of a faith that was as simple as it was sincere. Then that hardy chieftain died repeating his master's prayer, that prayer which divine love forced from the livid lips of a suffering and dying God. "Father, forgive them." Where there's a will, there's a way. Outside, nature was all aglow with the soft life of beautiful May. Amid the sweet blossoms of a nearby apple tree, a finch was reveling, filling the air with its cheery melodies. The schoolroom windows were wide open, and the sun-laden breezes, bearing along with them the songs of the bird in the apple tree, stole in and gently kissed the rosy cheeks and the yielding hair of many little students who were sitting so quiet and still at their desks, listening respectfully to the parish priest as he gave them fatherly admonitions and holy instructions. It was the week after Whitsuntide, and the first hour in Christian doctrine for those who had received First Holy Communion during that time of singular graces. Serious words that went home to the heart did the priest address to the little group, admonishing them to be ever faithful little soldiers of Christ. Then, turning to the whole school, he gave the command for which many a one had been impatiently waiting. "The First Holy Communion class for next year will please arise." And arise they did with a will, and with a certain feeling of responsibility, too, for well they knew that from now on sharp eyes would be watching their conduct everywhere. The priest gave them their places together in a conspicuous part of the room. 12 boys there were, and 14 girls. Their faces reflected the joy of their hearts, but Frank Steffer was the happiest of them all. Frank was a very poor lad. His father had been schoolmaster in a neighboring village, and had died young, while Frank was still in the cradle. From that day on, his mother had to work day and night to keep the wolf from the door. Often they were in bitter want. The art of doing without things was, accordingly, one of the boy's earliest lessons. But it was not the only one. He learned to pray also. Despite the many hardships, however, the good mother managed to find scores of ways in which to make her darling boy happy. Many a piece of furniture had to be disposed of in the course of time to make ends meet, but no matter how hard pressed, Mrs. Steffer never sold her husband's books. No, she read them again and again, and communicated as much of their contents to her son as he was able to grasp. And Frank was a bright lad. His sweet little mother and his father's books were the dearest things he had on earth.
and now he belonged to the first communicants of the coming year. The thought filled him with joy and pride so great that he could hear his heart thump and throb in exultation. Immediately after the close of school, Frank hastened home. With a shout of joy, he burst into the room where his mother was working. Everything was quickly told her with the volubility and frankness of childhood. How happy mother was, and how gladly she assented to everything. And yet, as soon as Frank had left her and was again playing with his friends, she could not but sigh deeply. From the boy's talk, she had noticed once again that nothing was nearer to his heart than the desire to study for the holy priesthood, to become a missionary. To become a missionary! How in the world did Frank ever get such an idea? Well, anyhow, he got it. He was intensely interested in the missions. He knew their geography as well as he did that of his own country, and there was nothing that he would not have deigned himself sooner than not give his regular donation to the Holy Childhood. He was all heart for the poor heathen babies. He wanted to lead each and every one of his colored brothers and sisters to the feet of the dear divine Savior. But now his mother knew that with all her care, her almost scrupulous sparing and saving, she could not afford to let her boy study, much as she would have liked to do so. Hence that deep sigh. Of course, the lively little barefooted boy did not let the thought of obstacles in the way distress him in the least. Indeed, what does a lad for whom no ditch is too broad, no tree too high, know about the impossible? And yet it would surely hurt him when he finally realized that the life of the missionary was not to be the life for him, when finally he would have to choose some calling that demanded a lesser outlay and promised quicker returns. We will continue with the story, Where There's a Will, There's a Way, on the next tape.